Welcome to the Speak Up Talk Radio Network. I am your hostess, Pat Rulo. We bring you hand-selected hosts, podcasts, and talk radio programming with listening options, 24/7 streaming, or listen on demand. We also feature one-on-one segments with important guests, people who have something to say that you need to hear. Visit speakuptalkradio.com. And right now, I have an important author with me. He is Paul de Blasi III, a psychologist and writer living in Albuquerque who has treated survivors of the dark side of religion for more than 30 years. His professional consultation practice, Soul Care, is devoted to the tending of the soul. Paul writes psychological thrillers with an emphasis on the dark side of the human psyche. The mestizo myth of Aztlan, its surreal beauty and natural magic, provides the setting for the dark phantasmagoric narrative in his fiction. He is a member of the Depth Psychology Alliance, the Transpersonal Psychology Association, and the International Association for Relational Psychoanalysis and Psychotherapy. And he's here right now to take us to the dark side and back. Welcome to the show, Paul.
Thank you. That was quite a bit, actually. During you going through that, I was a little overwhelmed.
I was like, is that really me? Yep, it's you. Oh, my gosh.
Oh, my goodness.
That's okay.
Well, thank you. Yes, it's wonderful to be here today. I've been looking forward to it.
Well, Paul, I love the name of your practice, Soul Care. Tell us about what you do.
Well, I am a clinical psychologist. I specialize in depth psychology and spirituality. And in depth psychology, the concept of the soul is all important. Carl Jung helped us with that, and we see that the psyche in Greek is psyche, and it means soul translated. And so psychotherapy is literally the tending of the soul. So, that's a help for a lot of patients. Soul care, the name, so it gives them something to remember. And specifically, I am a trauma specialist. I have dealt with a lot of the trauma fallout in the churches and helping people to heal from the religious trauma in their lives.
Interesting. I want to go there right now. So your book is titled The Unholy, and it explores
right.
the dark side of religion and the human striving for spiritual freedom. What do you mean by the dark side of religion?
When we're speaking of the dark side of religion, what we're speaking of is the ability any religion has, any organized form of spirituality, to exercise a pretty vicious and often traumatizing sense of power and control over human beings. And it is very hurtful, extremely damaging, and can be quite traumatic to individuals, and that is the dark side of religion.
Mm-hmm. I believe I've experienced that as a young child growing up Catholic. I went to public schools, and going to catechism, I have to tell you, we were berated like you wouldn't believe. They would say, we told our students to put everything away because the public school kids are coming and they steal everything. And teachers and nuns calling my brother Four Eyes. And there was a lot that went on as kids, and we even knew that was wrong. And to this very day, it still turns me off. So I was wondering if those were the kind of things that you meant by the dark side of religion.
Sure. The dark side of religion being any way of demeaning a human being within a religious context, to include emotional, physical, or sexual abuse, which, of course, has been rampant in the media these days.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Taking that sexual abuse outside, what about just that emotional and spiritual? Why does that happen?
Well, you know, every religion was founded on an initial sense of inspiration, very powerful spiritual inspiration. I had one individual say to me, you know, in my mind, Jesus was like this John Lennon figure singing playing his guitar and saying, give peace a chance. And then all of a sudden we have this huge enterprise built on that, and people are laden with guilt and fear, and it comes from a sense of initial inspiration that people then capitalize on, and they build a huge edifice of an organization And then we as vulnerable human beings want something to tell, something or someone to tell us how to live, what will help us. And so religion is turned into an enterprise or a business, and it capitalizes on the human need for guidance and spiritual and emotional help. And when individuals, males, females, clergy, then take that power and run with it, people are hurt.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting that you use the word enterprise, because it is. And an enterprise based on fear and guilt is pretty darn scary thing. Now, rather than writing a self-help book, you made an interesting decision to approach this whole realm of human suffering in fiction. What made you do that?
Well, in writing The Unholy, I approach very, very charged areas of human suffering. And my wife actually helped me, Kathy, or I call her Kate, and she said, you know, you ought to put this in story form. You have so much experience with this. Mm-hmm. And my previous books with previous publishers were in spirituality and psychology, and I talked to my publisher, and he said, you know, this is so charged. I think it might some churches might find it offensive, at least startling, if not offensive, and they needed to hold off from doing it. And Sunstone Press then picked up on the idea of bringing The Unholy to the public and to light in of course, story form. So my wife encouraged me, and the impulse behind that is that in stories we have symbols, images, drama that affect us on a very deep level, and it's more than having things laid out in, mm-hmm. in self-help form or in nonfiction form. Instead, we're told a story, and it's the images, it's the characters. Or I've had people say that in The Unholy, when they think of an abusive clergyman, they think of Archbishop William Enart, who is the epitome of evil in The Unholy. Mm-hmm. And he hurts people. And in this case, the protagonist is a very vulnerable young female healer struggling to find her way, a curandera. And he wants to do her in because she is opposed to him. So people remember the characters of Archbishop William Enart, and they remember the struggles of a young person trying to find their way, a vulnerable soul, and they identify with those mm-hmm. Individuals, and they remember the characters and their plight and the scenes in a way that self-help may address, but this addresses in a different way, and in some ways, for this story, I think can be in a deeper way.
Mm-hmm. No, you're spot on. Folks can identify with the character rather than saying, don't do this and be sure to do that. So,
right,
yeah.
Right.
No, I think that was brilliant. And the combination of the fact that you live in New Mexico and that your background puts you exactly where you needed to be to write this book. So start by talking about the setting.
The setting is Aztlan. It's a mythological, phantasmagoric place. It's I call it a mythopoeic place because it's a symbolic place. New Mexico is the spiritual homeland for so many of us. My roots here and my wife's go back 400 years. I left for school in Colorado and Chicago and came back after my residency in Chicago and began practice here. And this is very much a spiritual homeland, but I wanted it to be obviously New Mexico to those who know of the area, but also more than New Mexico. It's this spiritual place. It's this place outside of time and space, if you would. Mm-hmm. And the word Aztlan came to mind because that is a mythic place for us. That is the center of the world for us. It's a mythic place of spiritual transformation and struggle and rebirth. Mm-hmm. And that is the setting of The Unholy.
Beautiful, beautiful. Why don't you then give us a synopsis of the book so we can start digging deeper into characters later on. So yeah, just give us a little idea of what the book's about.
Yeah, The Unholy is is set here in Aslan, and it's about a young curandera who is a young medicine woman who is trying to feverishly outrun destiny because medicine women are killed. And she remembers the plight of her mother. She witnessed the murder of her mother at the hands of a black-robed man on a dark and stormy night in the mountains in northern New Mexico. And she feels that to be a medicine woman means risking her life and to potentially die. So she is basically, as the story progresses, forced into what turns out to be a life and death battle against an evil archbishop.
My. And this is Claire Sanchez, yes? Your protagonist?
This is Claire Sanchez, and she lives in a world of the medicine women, a world of dreams and visions, shape-changing, and what they speak of as natural magic. Mm-hmm. And that is directly opposed to the institutional power of organized religion in the book called The Ecclesia Dei, mm-hmm. which is Latin for the Church of God.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Now, who is she to you, and where did she come from?
Oh, boy. Oh, my goodness. All of these characters, at one point or time or another, visited me in my dream.
Uh-huh.
And I mean that, literally. They came to me. She is a character that came through my dreams and my own struggle as a healer. Do I really want to do this? Can I do this? Especially, I think, although I was a well-trained psychologist, psychotherapist, I began coming face-to-face with the dark side of religion and seeing traumatized patients after patient after patient. Individuals hurt by institutional religion, and I struggled. Can I do this? And my own experience with organized religion and individuals telling me that if you continue to do this, this could jeopardize your standing in the church. It would essentially, in some ways, be the end of you. Now, in the story, Claire Sanchez's life is at risk, and she could lose this life, and she could be done in by the forces of religion. So there were some parallels. Of course, in dramatic fiction, everything is pushed out to a dramatic display of emotion and conflict. But certainly on a much lesser level, it was played out in my life and in the lives of many people who struggled with the dark side of religion. Mm-hmm. Archbishop Anarch, that character is just in the news, right? Mm-hmm. In one form or another, you know, whether it's the film Spotlight or the Hunchback of Notre Dame, or you have the evil prelate or the evil archbishop, and the vulnerable individuals that they can take advantage of under the pretext of taking care of them. And that is Archbishop Anarch. Mm. And that character was also would come in my dreams and many a nightmare about Anarch that informed the writing of this dramatic piece of fiction, The Unholy.
Wow.
This is so... Yeah, I got to tell you, I've written nonfiction, and I continue to with my blogs and professional articles in trauma and psychology and spirituality. But I'll tell you what's so different in writing a novel, and I have another one coming up that should be released within the year. But you live through these things, mm-hmm. in a way that's far different than with nonfiction. So it's really hot; it's white hot on the page and in the life of the writer. It certainly was for me.
No, I get that, and I can feel that as you're speaking. I'm going to skip to something I was going to ask you later, but as you're speaking, mm-hmm. I wanted to ask you this, that you say that you write psychological thrillers and dark fantasy, but in reality, you really write horror. Let's talk about that.
The Unholy has won two book awards. It won the 2013 International Book Award for New Age Fiction, and then it won the 2014 Pinnacle Book Award for Metaphysical Thriller. Now, I thought, wow, that's interesting, because really, in the story of the unholy, what's laced through here is horror. Mm-hmm. And it's not the typical sort of violence-driven horror, just explicit, overt violence. This is more of a psychological violence that occurs, mm-hmm. although there is explicit violence in the book, too. But this is a type of horror that leaves the person very unsettled, but yet hopeful that if the right decisions are made, there could be something come out of this, both unexpected and potentially transformative. But it is horrifying.
Mm-hmm.
It is horrifying. So there is this undergirding of horror, but I see it more as the old Gothic type of horror rather than anything more modern mm-hmm. or contemporary, because the old writers such as Algernon Blackwood and H.P. Lovecraft have really been in their own dark ways, a source of inspiration for me.
Okay. Yeah, I was going to ask you why you like this genre, why you like to write in this form.
Yeah. It's, in dealing with trauma, and my thrillers are trauma-based, in dealing with that dark Gothic fiction is just such a wonderful venue. And because it takes us to those regions of the psyche that are really mysterious mm-hmm. and horrifying. It's like a nightmare. The only thing is that you know this is a book, so there's going to be an end, and you hope it's going to turn out all right.
Exactly.
Whereas a nightmare, we can feel stuck in. You know, mm-hmm. we're not sure what's going to happen or if we're going to wake up.
Oh, my gosh. So what would you say is the central theme or the central message of the book, The Unholy?
In looking at The Unholy as exploring the dark side of religion, that when we speak of religion, of course, we're speaking of the dark side of religion, the theme of it is that religion kills.
Okay.
And it's a very sort of potent theme, and it sounds so dark and so cautionary, but yet in the story itself, as with any good sort of theme, there's a comma that comes after that, and it's like religion kills unless, mm-hmm. religion kills if. And so there's a qualifier in there that the story itself then helps to elaborate on.
Okay, got it. So did you learn anything as you were writing this, learn anything about yourself, let's say?
I did. And I surprised myself, but I surprised myself with the help of my wife and my family, a wonderful book people at Sunstone Press, my publisher, and a wonderful editor, and that is that I can have some stick-to-itiveness, because this was a rather arduous journey, and there were so many times I wanted to just give it up, because writing fiction wasn't something I'd been trained for, so this was easily a 10-year journey for me. And I later came to find out that good novels, substantial novels, and I've been told that The Unholy is a good novel, just take time, and that this sort of discouragement is part of the process. So I've realized that I have an unrelenting aspect to my personality that serves me in good stead.
You didn't know you were so persistent, did you?
That's right.
I like that. Sounds like your wife is very instrumental in helping you with this, huh?
She's wonderful. Yeah. We've been married 39 years, have 4 children, and 2 writers, 2 artists. My wife is an artist and a art historian, and she's just a wonderful source of continual inspiration. Yeah.
Oh, I love that. That's good. Well, now the cover image for The Unholy is striking and it's haunting. Mm-hmm. Tell us how you decided upon that image.
Yes, the cover image is that image of the Devil's Throne. And this is a literal place in northern New Mexico. It is between Albuquerque and Santa Fe on the Turquoise Trail.
Uh-huh.
And this image struck me many a time driving that way, and I told my wife, I'm going to use this image on the front cover if my publisher agrees and the artist can render it. And literally, I just described this image to the artist. And just like in, we were on the phone, I described the image, and they sent this image back to me, and I said, holy Moses, that's it.
Oh.
And that was that. And this is a very dramatic rendition of the actual Devil's Throne along the Turquoise Trail in northern New Mexico. Reputedly, the Devil's Throne is a haunted realm, and in the novel, it is a very haunted and very wicked place.
Oh, well, it is a haunting cover, and I'm glad that it's a real place, too.
Yes, it is.
Mm-hmm.
It is.
And that they were able
you
to...
You can see it right off the roadside.
I'm sure I've seen it many times as I passed through there on previous trips. Boy, now, is there anything that keeps you up at night? I mean, you're dreaming all these things. Do you get any sleep?
Oh, I do. You want to know when I had the best sleep, or not the best sleep, but a very good night's sleep? It's when I have a nightmare. I tell you, Pat. Nightmares are like the psyche going through a deep sweat. Mm-hmm. It leaves you refreshed, and if you're willing to learn from them. And I'm trained with dreams and I rely on them for guidance in my own life and with my patients. And I would say that the only thing that keeps me up at night is when I'm off track in some way in my life.
Mm-hmm.
And usually I'll whisper to myself during the night. And I'll just say, you know, whatever it is that I need to understand, I want to understand it, and just I'd like a dream about it. And 9 times out of 10, that dream will come. And then I'll sleep, and I'll know what it's about, and I'll self-correct, and I'll be back on my path. So I don't sleep well if I'm off balance in some way in my life. Otherwise, I sleep really well, thankfully.
Mm-hmm. I was going to say, at least you know how to self-correct.
I do. Yeah. I do, thankfully. Yes, that's something that's I've learned over time and try and help my patients with as well.
Yeah, I was going to say, with your background. Well, talking about your background, you're obviously a very busy man and you're working. Let's head over into some advice for writers. How do you balance all of that, and maybe give a tip or two for folks that are writers and workers at the same time?
That's such a good question, Pat, because it's so easy to get out of balance. And My youngest daughter, Victoria, is an artist. She's a Fulbright scholar and she lives in Florence, Italy. She's a studio artist, and she used to tell me something. She said, while I was writing, and she was finishing graduate school, and she would see the pace that I work at, and she would say, Dad, be careful for the muse. She wants to possess you.
Mm-hmm.
So when we're under inspiration, we can want to do it morning, noon, and night. And I can feel that same inspiration actually in psychotherapy, and I do a lot of psychotherapy. But what I've learned over the years is to know my limits, and I have those same limits with writing. I write consistently, but in a limited fashion. I have only so many hours a week that I will write. Then I stop. Otherwise, I will lose my balance, and then I won't sleep right and like. But the one thing is that I write every day.
Okay.
I do write every day. Mm-hmm. So what I would encourage writers with, especially younger writers who are still maybe haven't been published or are still trying to find their pace, is to be undeterring, unrelenting, and put a pen to the page every day or be on your computer every day. And Freud used to have a maxim that really helped me. And Freud wrote one page per day. And he published an enormous amount from that one page per day.
Right.
So I write steadily, and but I am in a limited capacity. Like Freud, about a page a day, maybe a little more. And then, of course, my editing is on top of that.
Right, right. And let's talk about the editing and the publishing process. You said that it took 10 years to finish the book. And so when you realized you were through with it. What was your process after that? You put this out to several publishing houses.
Oh my gosh, yes, yeah. Yes. This went in different forms. It just wasn't ready as I look back. It probably had 100 rejections through the years, but it just wasn't ready. And I had a lot of learning to do. And then finally it struck in a remarkable way with Sunstone Press. And I have to tell younger writers that when it hits, and stay with it because it will hit. So the writing is one process, and then the whole process of publication, and then PR. I really regard PR, book PR, as its own form of spiritual practice. Mm-hmm. And I attend social media daily. I have about a 50,000 person social media base, so that's important for writers to build that up and to do that. And I'm real steady with that. That's also something I'm continually working at. And each one of those phases, writing, publishing, and then PR, are part of the life of a writer. Mm-hmm. And editing as well. We need good editors. And we really need to have a good editor and beta readers that we can turn to get objective and objective eyes on our work.
Absolutely. It's so much more than just sitting down and writing. That whole PR, that whole marketing aspect of it is huge. So it's quite a balancing act to get all of this done effectively.
Yeah. Yep.
Now, what about reviews, both good and bad? How does your heart handle that?
You know, fantastically now. They used to wipe me out.
I bet.
You know, because I didn't know what was happening, because it's so much different again with fiction than nonfiction, because with fiction and the whole world of Amazon and social media, things just start flying. And I think I have over 50 reviews now, and we're going to have just about another 25 coming in this week, I hear, or this month. And some of them, I think on the average, I have 4 stars out of 5. Some people, you know, you have maybe a 1-3% absolutely hated the book. And then in my mind, that's who I would focus on. Like, oh my gosh, God, you know, what didn't I do, or what didn't I take care of? Then I self-corrected and I realized that's going to happen in anything.
Yes.
And then you start picking up with those that absolutely loved it. I get letters saying from people that it changed their lives. And so the bulk of it is good. You have some that is just extraordinarily powerful and positive, and some that are just highly critical. And so I've learned to roll with it and just keep doing what I do. And that's come over time.
You pour your heart and soul into something and you hear a review or a comment that just doesn't sit right. And that's the only thing that you dwell on. Although I think oftentimes, unless it's just totally a mean-spirited person writing it, there's usually maybe a little kernel of something that we can take away from that and think, oh, okay, I get it.
Oh, sure, yeah. Sure, you know, yeah, yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. I completely agree with you.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, now what's next for you? You mentioned you've got some books coming up.
Yes, I have other writing going on, but my next thriller coming out, hopefully within, probably not this year, but probably by the spring or the summer of 2017, is a supernatural thriller, just like The Unholy. And it is called Goddess of the Wild Thing. Mm-hmm. And it's about love, and that love is a wild thing. And it's a struggle to come to terms with it. In this story, there is a woman who is 38 years old with friends. And these are women who are struggling to discover love in their lives. And their biggest concern is that they've had so many bad experiences that they're not sure they can find their way to true love. And they begin to wonder if settling wouldn't be the best. And if bad love is the only love, maybe bad love is what you should take.
Ooh.
And the novel addresses that.
Oh, I look forward to that. Goddess of the Wild Thing. That's a awesome title.
Ah, thank you, thank you.
Love it, yeah.
I appreciate that because I've been struggling with that. My wife and I have been talking about that title, so thank you for the encouragement there.
No, I like it. Just based on the title, I would read it, and I'm trying to think of what your cover is going to look like.
That's going to be surprising.
All right. I'll wait for that. Oh, Paul, now is there anything we missed that you would like to talk about today?
Well, Pat, I got to say that I really enjoyed our talk. You've asked such an incisive questions. They've brought me back to the story in a sort of a fresh way. I hope the listeners will consider checking out the Unholy on Amazon, and it's the Unholy Paul de Blasi III, and my website is pauldeblasithird.com, and I'm also on Facebook and Twitter, Paul de Blasi III, and it's been a wonderful conversation. Mm-hmm. and for those who are wanting to have a chilling and thrilling read about the dark side of religion, I hope they'll consider The Unholy.
Oh, absolutely. After today's conversation, I don't see how someone would not. The book is called The Unholy by Paul de Blasi III, and it's the website pauldeblasithird.com. I knew this was going to be an exceptional conversation today, and I was right. Thank you so much, Paul, for sharing you and your book, and I look forward to your next one, Goddess of the Wild Thing. Thank you.
Thank you, Pat.